prevalent sexually transmitted disease. It's estimated that somewhere around 40 to 45% of women in their 20s have it. There isn't a test at this point for men. It's also the leading cause, some scientists say the only cause of cervical cancer. Recently, the FDA approved a vaccination for women or for females effective against many of the strains of HPV that cause cervical cancer. The Center for Disease Control recommended that the vaccination be administered to all girls at around age 11 or 12, right, an age before they're likely to become sexually active, because if they're exposed to the virus, then the vaccination won't do them any good. Nevertheless, the proposal to include the HPV vaccine along with the schedule of vaccinations for measles, mumps, rubella that kids get as a condition for enrollment in the sixth grade has become mired in controversy. The opponents of the HPV vaccination say that it actually might do more harm than good, that it might lull the vaccinated girls into a sense of false security that would lead them to engage in even more unprotected sex and increase the incidence maybe of HPV associated with the kinds of strains of the virus that aren't covered by the vaccination, but also maybe their risk of getting other kinds of sexually transmitted diseases like HIV. Right? They also worry about the possibility of at this point undetected or at least unreported side effects. They point out that Vioxx, that Merck, manufacturer Vioxx, also creates manufactures the HPV vaccination. Virtually all the states have considered proposals to have this universal vaccination for schoolgirls for HPV, but at this state, only one state has actually adopted the proposal. And so I want to start by asking you, you know, what do you think about the HPV vaccination and about the proposal to have all grade school girls be vaccinated? Do you have an opinion on it? Maybe the opinion is based on what I just told you, or maybe it's based on what you've already read about it. All right, so start with that. But now I want you to think about this. Why do you imagine that the people who might have an opinion different from yours, or if you don't even really have an opinion, just the people who have a really strong one way or the other, why do they feel the way that they do? Do you think that they just reading the newspaper articles or maybe the original studies on the effectiveness and the best studies we have or informed speculations we have about what the behavioral consequences of being vaccinated might be for schoolgirls, will they engage in sex and so forth, and coming to a different opinion from you, right? Or are they listening to certain people who present themselves as experts but really aren't? Right, or here's an even more pointed way to put it. Do you have an idea, if you think about it, you try to imagine, well, who is it who feels differently from me? Are you just drawing a blank, a kind of a silhouette, or do you actually see somebody, some kind of person that you can recognize? Or if I asked you this, do you have any hypotheses about what this person who feels differently about the HPV vaccine program from you thinks about, say, abortion laws or gun control laws or even climate change, right? And I'm betting you say, yeah, I think I do. And I'm saying to you, that's kind of curious, isn't it? This is the kind of thing that we study. And I'm going to tell you about an experiment that I and my collaborators who've been funded by the Reeb Housing Fund and other patrons have done that looks at the connection between people's beliefs about the risks and benefits of universal HPV vaccination for schoolgirls and their values, right? And also the relationship between their values and how they process information and how they react to certain information sources. Well, how do they rate the persuasiveness of people who are trying to give them information about what the risks and benefits of the HPV vaccine are, right? And we did a study that involved a large, diverse national sample, and what we did was measure the values of our subjects using a framework that is associated with the work of anthropologist Mary Douglas. Mary Douglas's framework characterizes people's worldviews or preferences about how society should be organized along two cross-cutting dimensions. Right? One measures how individualistic versus communitarian their preferences are. The other, how hierarchical or egalitarian. Right? What kind of society do people want to live in if you measure their values using scales that reflect this kind of framework? And what we found when we looked at one group of subjects was that there was, in fact, a pretty strong correlation, controlling for other factors, between people's values measured on within this framework and their beliefs about the risks and benefits of the HPV vaccine. Right. So the more hierarchical and the more individualistic somebody was, the more likely they were to believe that the HPV vaccine might in fact cause girls to become more sexually promiscuous, to expose themselves to other kinds of sexually transmitted diseases, the more likely they were to believe that there might be these bad side effects, the more likely they were to believe that the vaccine might not work after all, right? And by the same token, the more egalitarian and communitarian the were, the more likely they were to form the opposing sets of beliefs. This didn't surprise us. We actually thought this would happen. This is the result in what I'll call the no argument condition. We just asked people what they thought about these matters without giving them any kind of case, pro or con. But another group of subjects in the so-called balanced argument condition told us what they thought about these issues on relating to the HPV vaccine after we showed them what we thought were balanced arguments, the kinds of things people are saying about why it's a good idea to have universal vaccination of the school goes for HPV vaccine, with HPV, and the arguments that people are making for saying it's a bad idea. I don't know, the balanced arguments, maybe people are going to agree or something, but in fact, what happens is that the difference between people on cultural lines expands, right? So everybody actually is a little bit more concerned. All of a sudden, you're giving even more vivid explanation about some pretty scary things. So it's not surprising that their risk arousal is heightened generally, right? But relative to their counterparts in the no argument condition, the hierarchical individualists, right, are attending to this information in a way that makes them even more convinced that the risks are going to predominate than the egalitarian communitarians relative to people in the no argument condition, right? Now, then the next thing we did, well, these are culturally identifiable advocates. Right? What we found is that if you show a picture of one of these persons to test subjects and you describe him as a policy expert at a major university, then people will tend to have shared beliefs about what the values of this person are likely to be, measured with the same Mary Douglas scale, group grid, she calls it, framework, right? And you can increase the effect even more by adding mock CVs, right? So then we wanted to see, well, what's going to happen to people, another group of people, when we ask them what they think of the HPV vaccine once they've received arguments that have been randomly attributed to these culturally identifiable advocates. And what we found is that the positions that people had about the HPV vaccine proposal at that stage was highly conditional on the relationship between their values and the perceived values of the advocates who are giving them the pro or con positions, right? So if the subjects got the argument that we would say they were culturally predisposed to believe based on the patterns you see in these conditions from an advocate whose values were like theirs, or we expected them to perceive were like theirs. And if they got the argument that they were predisposed to reject from the advocate who we thought they would see as having values alien from theirs, well then you actually got even more cultural polarization, right? So if the hierarchical individualist saw the guy in the upper right.
How did the picture work? So you put the picture next to the artist?
Yes, put the picture, here's what two university experts, major universities, here's what their arguments are.
Did you
tell us?
Oh
yeah, it's completely randomized, and so
So the suit guy could have said.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's one condition, right? Where essentially, if you have the suit guy, or a couple of suit guys, but you have the guy in the upper right, you know, he's saying, hey, this is a bad idea, you know. Versus, you know, here this guy, he looks like a university professor, doesn't he?
So.
No, that people perceive these people as having different values, right? So, I mean, we do determine that with a pretest. Now, in the expected argument condition, you're getting the argument from that you are predisposed to accept from the advocate whose values are like yours. The argument you're predisposed to reject from the advocate whose values aren't like yours, you get the polarization. Of course, the next question is, what happens if you get the argument you're predisposed to reject from the advocate who you perceive as having your values, and the argument that you're predisposed to accept now all of a sudden coming from, you know, this guy in the other quadrant whose values seem alien from yours, right? And I say, you, and these are all between subjects, right? But now you see there's this convergence, right? We also had another condition where people are seeing on both sides of the issue people whose values are either like theirs or not like theirs. So kind of a pluralistic argument condition, or maybe one way to just look at it is like this. You know, there's no arguments, there's a little bit of polarization. If you have balanced arguments, people become more polarized, right? If you have an alignment that they would expect to see, the person like them are arguing for the position they're predisposed to accept, even more polarization. Could flip things around, you know, you almost eliminate the polarization, and then if it's kind of in the middle, you know, less polarization, kind of a middling, all right? Well, now you're in a position to understand what I mean when I say the laws of cultural cognition. Right? Cultural cognition refers to the general tendency of people to form beliefs about the risks and benefits of putatively dangerous activities that match their cultural evaluations of them. The laws of cultural cognition are the discrete psychological mechanisms that explain why you see that kind of dynamic. One of these you could call self-defensive cognition. It's kind of unsettling to believe that the activities that you think are base, immoral, actually are good for society, or that the activities you think are honorable, important to you, well, they're bad for society. Right? One of the reasons that's unsettling is because if you form beliefs like that, you might find yourself in opposition to lots of your friends who happen to share your values, right, and whose respect and support you might value and you might need. Right? So you're naturally disposed not to form beliefs like that, and that might be an explanation, or I think we think it is the explanation, it's the one we hypothesized, about why you would see that initial disagreement between the hierarchy individualists on the one hand and the egalitarian communitarians and the HPV experiment, that the social meanings of the policies would have a relationship with their cultural values. But we've done other studies too where I think that effect, the identity protective cognition is even stronger. So, for example, owning a gun turns out to be very much connected to certain kinds of social roles, like being a father or a protector or a provider, or to certain kinds of character traits, like being courageous, self-reliant, that are important to people who have hierarchical individualistic values, but in particular to men who have hierarchical and individualistic values, and in particular, white men who have hierarchical and individualistic values, right? They have the biggest stake in owning a gun. Consequently, they're the ones who are the most motivated to reject the idea that owning a gun is actually going to put them and their family members at risk. They're also the ones most likely to accept the claim that taking away their gun or having gun control is going to expose them and their family to risk of being a victim of violent predation. Right? Another mechanism here, culturally biased assimilation and polarization. Right? Maybe because of self-defensive cognition, people tend to process information in a way that reinforces their cultural priors, right? So they accept the argument that matches their cultural beliefs and they reject the arguments that don't. As a result, if you give people balanced information, they don't tend to converge, right? They tend to polarize. They're finding even more evidence that supports their position. That's why you see that you get cultural polarization in the argument without advocates condition in our experiment. But we've done this too with other things, including nanotechnology, which was really interesting because even if you are more likely to know about HPV than the average person, there's still, I bet most of you don't know what nanotechnology really is, even if you have an iPod Nano, right? But it's around 80% of the people don't know what nanotechnology is. 90% have an opinion one way or the other. But it's just kind of noise, right? Because they really don't know what it is. Now, if you have another group of people and you give them a bit of balanced information, right? Here are some of the good things people say I can do. Here are some of the risks they're worrying about. All of a sudden, they polarize along cultural lines, right? Lines that reflect their cultural predispositions toward environmental risks generally, right? So individualists think, oh, that's ridiculous, because they like commerce, they like industry. They don't want to believe that commerce and industry causes bad things. Egalitarians in commerce and industry, sources of inequality, you know, congenial to believe that those things are dangerous and should be restricted so you can produce the same result. The another law is cultural credibility. Most of us aren't in a position, all of us aren't in a position to figure out through personal investigation or personal research what to believe about complicated issues of risk, right? So we have to decide which experts we're going to believe to tell us, you know, what kinds of claims are credible, which are ridiculous, whose data we should trust and who's not. Well, the people we tend to trust, it turns out, the ones to whom we impute knowledge, competence, honesty, are the ones who share our values, right? Or maybe we listen to them because we perceive that that's a good signal, that if they believe that, other people like me probably believe that, and to protect my identity, it would be useful for me to believe that. We perceive it subconsciously. So, right, so you get this kind of very interesting cultural credibility effect, and I showed you that with the HPV vaccine. We've done this with other things too, including nanotechnology and climate change. Now, there are other laws, but I'm going to talk now about the cultural cognition of law. What's the significance of cultural cognition for legal decision making? And one area where it's obviously relevant is in risk regulation. Right? Debates about risk regulation are informed by two dominant theories. You might call one of these the rational weigher theory, which says that individuals in aggregate and over time basically process information in a way that's going to allow them to maximize their expected utility. Then there's the irrational weigher model, which says that people aren't capable of processing information in that way because of cognitive biases and other kinds of defects in rationality. Right? Neither of those theories, though, explains why you see the correlation between beliefs about risk and people's cultural values. Right? It isn't the case that the hierarchs and egalitarians have access to different information sources. It isn't the case that one or the other is more bounded or less bounded in its rationality, right? Only a theory that's informed by cultural cognition, right, which we call the cultural evaluator theory, can explain that, right? In a series of papers, I and some of my collaborators have explored what the normative and prescriptive implications are. They're pretty distinctive of the cultural evaluator theory. We've also done studies on the effect of cultural cognition on legally consequential facts, essentially in adjudicatory settings. Right? Will cultural cognition influence people's perceptions of facts, say in a self-defense case? This was one thing that Don Brayman and I investigated in one study. We actually have another study that extends this, but we're still working on it. Right? Here's what we did. We gave one of two vignettes to the subjects, and the vignettes were parallel in certain critical ways relating to factual issues that are important for self-defense, but that were ambiguous in our vignettes. Right? So did the victim, the person against whom deadly force was used, really pose a threat? Right? Did the defendant honestly perceive that that person posed a danger to him, right, or her? Was the defendant's judgment perhaps impaired by past instances of violence? Or maybe those past instances of violence gave the defendant special insight into actually how dangerous the situation was, right? One way or the other, you could argue it. Were there other non-lethal alternatives to using deadly force? In both versions of the vignette, these are ambiguous facts. Right? In one version of the vignette, the defendant is a battered woman and the victim is a sleeping husband. In the other, it's a beleaguered commuter who lashes out and kills the panhandling teen. Right? That's the Bernard Goetz case. And so what we found, as we predicted, is that people's perceptions of the facts in these cases would be conditional on their cultural outlook. So the hierarchical individualist basically formed anti-defendant views in the battered woman case, that the egalitarian communitarian pro-defendant views flipped around in the beleaguered commuter case, right? So the hierarchical individualist is more pro-defendant, resolving these same factual ambiguities in a way that's pro-defendant in the beleaguered commuter case, and the egalitarian communitarian more anti-defendant. Now, our evidence also allowed us to examine some hypotheses about the relationship between people's values and their beliefs, factual beliefs, and their judgments about what the outcome should be in these cases, right? So here's Chief Justice Roberts' model, the neutral umpire, right? The neutral umpire in this case would just call the case, you know, like he sees them. Look at the facts. I'm not going to let culturally partisan rooting interests distort things. Evidence didn't really fit that. Maybe you think then it fits this one, a partisan judgment hypothesis. People are deciding on the basis of their values. Who cares what the facts are, right? So this is like Alan Dershowitz, the abuse excuse, right, or something. Or people who would say the same thing, vigilante justice, in a case like Bernard Goetz. Well, the evidence didn't fit that hypothesis either. It fit a hypothesis like this, we call the cultural cognition hypothesis. People are deciding the cases on the basis of the facts. But what explains the differences in their perceptions of the facts are their cultural values, right? So people are motivated, probably because of self-defensive or identity-protective cognition, right, to form beliefs about these ambiguous facts that match their cultural appraisals of the characters of the defendants and the victims in these cases. Now, here another thing we looked at was how cultural cognition influences people's perceptions of risk in a high-speed car chase. The Supreme Court, in a case Scott v. Harris, held that it doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment for the police to use deadly force, namely ramming their car into that of a fleeing motorist and causing it to flip over and him to break his neck, right, to end a high-speed car chase. And what was decisive to them in that case was a videotape that was shot from inside one of the fleeing cruisers. Right? And Justice Scalia, writing for an 8-justice majority, said, no reasonable juror could watch that tape and fail to conclude that the fleeing driver posed a risk of death to the public and the police sufficiently great to make it reasonable for the police to use deadly force against him. And there was one justice, Stevens, who watched the tape and said, I didn't see that. It looked like what happens when I'm in a hurry on the way to work and I cross the center line in the oncoming traffic to pass the slowpoke. Well, you can't, you know, what can you do? The court didn't try to argue with him about it. They just put a link to the video into their opinion. This was a first. We're happy to let the video speak for itself, says Justice Scalia. So we let it speak to a sample of 1,350 people, diverse national sample. right? And we found that although a majority did see things the way the court did, there were very profound cultural differences at the individual level, and we used Monte Carlo simulations with our data to try to show how this works. But right, somebody who's like Ron, a hierarchical individualist, right? He's already Sarah Palin supporter for 2008. He's extremely likely to see things the way the court does. You know, somebody like Bernie, Linda, these are communitarian, egalitarians. They're much less likely to agree with the court. Then you've got Pat, who's the average American in all respects, including gender, who's somewhere in the middle, right? But basically closer, at least on this issue, to Ron, okay? Now, we've got more studies that look at the impact. Let's quickly wrap up here, because the one I want to do now, there are more studies that look at the fact issues, but I want to tell you about studies we want to do, studies for which we need more funding, right? So one of these has to do with judicial reasoning.
Were these studies linked up with the first one? So the question would be, if you bring back your experts were, right, and in the vignette setting or the video setting, put faces of experts, do people learn or change? Just like in the first experiment, you find that you can actually, the cultural, if we look at sort of your direction,
are they learning?
Values may not necessarily overweight their perception.
Well, you know something, that this is, maybe I just flip right to the end, because I want to say one thing we want to have is debiasing, right? I actually don't think that every perception that reflects cultural cognition should be understood as a product of bias or error. And I think maybe even in a case like Scott v. Harris, you know, people are seeing the facts differently, but it's really hard to disentangle the issues of risk from evaluations there. And maybe if you told people that, in fact, the two are blending together, that wouldn't bother them, right? Because it's really kind of weird to separate them. And it was kind of weird that the Supreme Court justices were just focusing on how many red lights he ran and so forth. Like, kind of, it really seems like there's more to the story about how you're going to apportion blame. And so cultural cognition is actually connecting your fact perceptions to your values there in an important way. But sometimes I think we would view cultural cognition as interfering with the kinds of judgments we want to make. I think in the self-defense setting, people don't want to condition the law's protection on whether they like somebody's character or not. I think they want to be neutral umpires. I think if you showed them what was happening, they would be disappointed. If they would be disappointed, then presumably they want some kind of procedures that would help to protect that from happening, prevent it from happening. What are they? Right? Well, we've got some examples in risk perception studies. And actually the cultural credibility heuristic suggests one thing you can do, right? I don't know if you can try to flip things around, you know, and just confuse everybody but maybe you maybe if you have a pluralistic environment, right, in that environment, when you can't tell who's on what side, that's not no longer a cue you're relying on. You're attending to the information. I don't know. Is there a judicial analog, right, for that? There might be other things. They might involve deliberation, which I think is a really important thing we haven't looked at. We've been looking at what happens when people look at these issues in isolation. Obviously, juries don't. Judges wouldn't if they're on panels. And again, I think we do need to extend this to judicial reasoning. In a sense, the Scott v. Harris study is an indirect test of the impact of cultural cognition on judicial reasoning. Right? The way it's an indirect test is that there's another law of cultural cognition, naive realism. And naive realism says that we're pretty good at identifying when cultural values might be influencing the fact perceptions of other people. That's where we're pretty realistic. Where we're naive is not understanding how it affects our own. And so maybe the justices, right, in saying no reasonable juror could possibly see things differently because they imagine only Bernie, Linda, they don't imagine, you know, why their own values might be involved in how they come out, how the case should come out. You know, that's a normative issue. But not to be aware of that, that's unfortunate. And by the way, at the beginning, when I said, could you imagine who these people are? Do they have a face who disagree with you on HPV? Do you think they're listening? You probably were being very realistic in identifying who they were and why they But were you being a little naive, maybe, and not wondering whether it also affected you? And we say, hey, how about some humility on the part of the court? Can you imagine? If you think about the person who's going to disagree with you, and he's just a statistical outlier, you know, faceless, just a silhouette, fine, you know, unreasonable. But if you imagine this person, and you know who it is, you know what their values are, you know what they think about abortion, about gun control, well, then you know that it's that kind of issue. You have to have a reason different from just, you know, nobody thinks that way. Right? Maybe there isn't any good reason not to at least listen to people in that circumstance. But better yet would be to do some experiments with judges as subjects. Jeff Reklinsky has done this, and I think we would love to do that. It'll only cost him $5-6 million. Okay, that's all I have. Oh, well, there's one actually, the other important thing, because I know you're going to just preempt this, and here's exactly how it works. Our time has come. That's what actually it says it on The Economist this week. You know, what does it mean? Our time has come. Everybody thinks of somebody different. There was something in the New York Times this Sunday. It's, you know, the whatever, post-baby generation sees Obama and thinks its time has come, right? I look at it, the time for former presidents of the Harvard Law Review has come to rule the world, you know? And of course, to the African-American, our time has come, and maybe multiple of those at once. Here's a pretty interesting character, you know? He manages to be in the, you know, all of the boxes, or at least that's one possibility. And so finally, that's the last. All right. Yeah.
What happens to the data around the borders between the classes? Does it, if you have sort of more independence or maybe just indecisive people, how do they fall?
Well, I mean, the effects tend to be, you know, well, I mean, in a sense, it's linear because of the more of one thing you feel, the more effect you get. But if I show you, I mean, the difference is really, you know, if I can do this in a number of different ways, but if I do something like, you know, if I do something like, do like this, you know, well, how am I defining hierarchical individualists and egalitarian communitarians? Right? I can do this with mean splits, you know, and just figure out, so basically, what is the average person who's average along both of those dimensions, or I can push it out one standard deviation. But these aren't people really, you know, at the fringes. So you know, even it makes a pretty big difference even at the mean, right? So, I mean, the people in the middle are more middling, right? But the point is, given the natural distribution, we don't have like a, you know, this kind of bell curve. We have enough so that there's enough variation. But, you know, it's a good question, and I think deliberation would help with something like that too, because it might be the case that, you know, some people are more quick to form judgments that reflect their cultural values, but that they also influence the others because of the effect of social influence. People might be very kind of insular in who they talk to, right? And so even if they themselves aren't as partisan about it, that might have an impact. And so a lot of that stuff you'd have to kind of sort out. But yeah, Shane.
So in the balanced argument condition, how do you equate rhetorical strength? What criteria do you use?
Well, you know, this is, I'll tell you, I think that in the balance, I can show you what the balanced arguments were, and we tried to make them, and you tell me what maybe would be a better design for this, but, and I think, I'm sure we made a mistake in not trying to pretest this more because we got that big main effect. Here they are. And really, they just say the same thing, but they're kind of like the opposite of each other, you know, like that, or they're just kind of different ways of saying the same thing, like, oh, you know, it accounts for 70% of the cancers. Oh, but it leaves 30%, you know, uncovered, and so forth and so on. I mean, these are basically just arguments that people use, and we tried to have the same number of claims. Now, but we didn't pretest them to see, you know, whether they were balanced, or you know, what would be the test with that they have no main effect. And I, you know, I'm not sure. In the lab, something might have no main effect. I think in the world they probably have main effects, and what you're interested in is whether they're individual differences, right? We did a nanotechnology study where it was the case you gave people balanced information. And what was interesting about it, the information, like, rhetorically was balanced. So even when we said, here are the good things nanotechnology can do, we said it can maybe use to clean the environment, which is something you think an egalitarian would kind of like. But it's also going to be great for light tennis rackets, which is consumerism. You know, egalitarian doesn't like that. here are some of the things that are that could be risky for you. You could inhale it and get caught in your lungs. Individual has said, BS, you know, has another puff on a cigarette. They always say that. But it might also be used to invade your privacy. Well, why doesn't that scare him? You know, nevertheless, we've got the, you know, they pick up somehow on the resonances, even in the information there that seems balanced. There was no main effect. So it's really pretty. You just get, you know, it's all of the, if you look at the main effect, it's straight across. All of the differences are individual differences. But I think that, you know, what would you recommend to do something like that?
That's a very tough question. I really see that.
Well, then why'd you ask me? That wasn't very nice. You didn't have an answer? You just asked me a tough question? You're not even a law professor. Yeah?
But there are these other things we know in training, like in terms of percent. So maybe instead of saying, well, no help for 30%,
that's true.
But like helps only 70%. I mean,
yeah, but that's true. That's the main effect, and so, you know, both people got both versions, and so, I mean, it's true. You know, and I'll tell you another thing. If you look at the, I'll tell you, there got to be all kinds of main effects, risk perception effects in a case like the Scott B. Harris video. I mean, you're seeing it from inside the police car. How does that affect the risk? You see somebody crash at the end, which you might say, well, you know, hindsight bias or something like that. But of course, those are all main effects, and we're looking at individual differences. But I do think one thing that we find a lot in our designs is that as soon as you start to give people more vivid information, you see a big main effect towards risk concern. So we've done one study, for example, where we try to look at framing effects for nanotechnology, and this is really, well, you know, I think we just didn't anticipate this. It's an interesting result, but I don't think we can say, well, now we've discovered this. We produced this. We thought, we didn't think, you know, but maybe we'll do another study. But the what happened is that if you give people frames that emphasize risk mitigation, like so nanotechnology for tennis rackets, you know, okay, egalitarians don't like that, individualists, that they think it's great. Nanotechnology to clean the environment, you know, and maybe firms will do really, you know, will be able to make money by developing technologies to clean arsenic out of the groundwater. Now, you see, arsenic out of the groundwater is very scary, right? Now, at this point, we're talking about nanotechnology and its risk abating properties. Nevertheless, people perceive nanotechnology as a main effect to be more risky in that condition, right? We did get individual differences so that in fact there was more, they were starting to converge at that point. But the main effect was so much bigger, you know. So as soon as you start to give people information, you're contending with the vividness. If I tried to squeeze that out, I'm not sure I'd have external validity, because I'm not sure the information would resemble anything they're likely to see. The people, things they see in the world tend to be vivid, right? And the vivid things might have main effects. But I think as a policy matter, you're mainly, in this kind of situation, you're interested in individual differences, because the individual differences are going to create conflict, right? The dynamics that create the individual differences, we probably think, are preventing somebody, maybe both, from actually attending to the actual content of the information. They're being distracted by extraneous things. Yeah.
Well, I think this works very well for analysis of risk. But when you look at translation to policy, there seems almost a bias. There are some people, if you go along with communitarian versus individual, another way you can think of it is communitarian as being sort of utilitarian, and individualist is sort of an ideological position of, yes, we could do that, but it's not our role to do that.
Yeah.
And
that's interesting.
So it's not necessarily that's sort of a different factor than risk, because their position as individualists is saying, well, yeah, I know it would help, but it's not our job to do that.
Yeah. Well, here are a couple things. One is that there's nothing magic in my view about this framework. If you tell me it's ideology, and if you want to do this with liberalism and conservatism, you can, because you're still going to be showing that people, something about their outlooks, their values, is motivating their cognition. Right? And here's the second thing. I'm looking at problems where the agreement is pretty much agree on the ends. How do we have a safe society? Right? How do we make ourselves secure from risks, from aggressors, or to the environment? But they're disagreeing about the means, right? And they're disagreeing about the means, it turns out, because they have different values, well, they're motivated by their values to accept certain kinds of facts, and you know, you might have a different way to measure the values. I say, well, let's find the best scheme. The best one explains the most and also gives us the most traction and insight for trying to come up with ways to deal with this. And I do think this is better than ideology. It's better than ideology because, for one thing, a lot of times ideological measures don't pick this up. And in particular, they don't pick it up for people who are who have relatively low political sophistication. This is something political scientists know, that the power of ideology measures to explain variance is very conditional on, you know, how plugged in are you to, you know, kind of use little civics tests, which you might have thought was kind of a ridiculous way to do it. But I mean, look at Sarah Palin, doesn't even know what member, you know, person in the Senate. But anyway, I don't want to be partisan here. But these work even for people who have low political sophistication, which is one of Aaron Woldovsky, he's a collaborator of Mary Douglas. His claim was that, oh, culture is kind of the heuristic because it's closer, more accessible, right, to ordinary people. Now, one last point on this. I think it's relevant to policy of the sort I'm describing, where the issue is about fact, right, and means to an end. And I think most of our policy is about that we are not a particularly partisan group, you know, in our society. We're not trying to impose our values down each other's throats. We're just trying to figure out, you know, how to put food on the table. But it turns out our values end up helping us to do that. If you're talking about a policy where it is just values, yeah, this will explain it too. But then, you know, there's not that. That's not the kind of, you know. Of course, that's what it is. Utilitarianism. Where does that come out? I don't know. I sure know Richard Epstein. Well, maybe he's a weird guy. I don't know. Yeah.
I just wanted to know, was there any aspect of
Yeah, well, sometimes. I mean, these ones, I mean, well, here. Sure, there are, like, I just gave you the example, too, about the framing study, which, you know, to me, there were interesting things. We did learn things, and I don't think that, you know, the information is useless just because it wasn't what we expected. But I do agree that if you get something that wasn't what you expected, and it's kind of interesting, you shouldn't then say, well, look at this interesting thing. You know, but that should then suggest, well, maybe some other things you should be looking at. Right, so there was something unexpected. You know, also I do think, you know, you can always improve the design. I wish there weren't as big a main effect for some of these, you know, in the information conditions. Yeah, so sometimes you see things. But here's something too that it's just a practical point that I learned from other people that I worked with. If you have a benefactor, you know, who's generous enough to support your research, a responsible thing to do is to hedge a bit with your to try to have a mixed portfolio of research objectives. You don't want to be all on one kind of finding and kind of rolling the dice and hoping. I mean, yeah, you might have your main thing that you want to figure out, but if it's gonna, it might fail, might very well fail. So it's good to have enough things going on in this. You know, if you put together a big study to try to leverage it. You know, we try to find research partners who will come in, and since we've already made an upfront investment to collect subjects, they'll, you know, we'll run some additional studies with you and so forth. If you kind of you try to diversify enough so that you minimize the risk of a complete strikeout, which would be really, I think, disappointing and make it less likely anybody will ever give you money again. Of course, if a lot of things work, then it's even better. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to mouse lab some of these things. You know, mouse lab where it's just a software program that allows subjects to kind of click. There's information behind boxes and they can peek to see. And what would be interesting to see if I'm a behavioral economist, right, so I'm very sympathetic with this bias idea. But it would still be, it should be interesting to see what people, what information people want to look at. Mm-hmm. So do people, if you know the possible four pictures of the dude,
absolutely.
Do you want to look to see who it comes from? Because some people might say, look, Dan, you know, if Shane tells me some argument, and I agree with Shane on a lot of things, that tells me, you know, I can agree with him because it's not an ad hominem, that he is endorsing it tells me something.
Yeah.
And maybe.
But maybe it tells something about you that you want to hear from Shane.
Picture.
Right? So if I show you these pictures, and of course this is part of why, I mean, this is what normally we expect to see, you know, this is the condition we normally expect to see, right? In part because people there's selection bias in which kinds of experts you're exposed to. You know, I'm going to tune into that guy. He's on Fox News. That guy's Lou Dobbs. I'm going to watch him. you know, I'm going to watch him or listen to him on whatever, you know, WBBI radio in New York, or something like this, you know, or so, whatever. So and I'll tell you, I mean, that person might be picking that personality. Well, he's most, you know, like me, or he. But you know, that's already part of the phenomenon. And if it's not like, you know, tell me what I should think about some issue of value, but which of these guys are going to tell me about the HPV? Now, we have some information. I mean, what you described, we should do even more on information seeking.
Right.
But one of the papers we have that's coming out on nanotechnology, one of the things it does is look at exactly that. I mean, there's this phenomenon that the more people know about nanotechnology, the more they like it. And so some people say, oh, that's great. The more, you know, once everybody learns about it, now only very few people do, everybody will like it, right? But of course, the problem is, well, what is it about these people that they're strange? They're going out and learning about nanotechnology. Right, and so we found that these people who know a lot about nanotechnology and who aren't worried about it, they also aren't worried about mad cow disease. They're not worried about, you know, pornography eroding our morals. They're not worried about the internet. You know, they are already somebody with a pro technology, you know, and environmental risk skeptical profile. So it influences the information seeking. You kind of inject information unwillingly into the egalitarian communitarian. The box he wouldn't have picked. He opens the box and he sees Ron up there and he's like, ah! You know, he does exactly the opposite. So
you get a selection of the type of people who want to find that information, and also you can show, like, look, if you didn't even look, so you're showing that you wouldn't pay to see what the guy looked like who said this, you've already demonstrated that this information shouldn't influence your cognition.
Yeah, well, that's,
it does, right? And so you can put it. You can look at how much people are willing to pay for this kind of information you're saying is infecting their cognition. So a mismatch between how much they seek it out versus how much it affects them.
Maybe they know less, you know, because in fact they have to have some way to evaluate whether if they view the cultural effect as noise, you know, the noise to signal ratio, they might be doing a bad investment when they pay. Yeah. Or maybe they should pay to get somebody they're not gonna know who it is. You know, yeah.
Unless there was another question, I did have a question on this, which I think is another interesting issue, is can you unpack sort of these sort of on these belief strains of whether people have a view of what they think an expert should look like, and people have a view of whether we should pay attention to experts, right? And so, I mean, I'm wondering, so if you think about sort of in these like stylized stereotypes, so I guess in your stereotype, the people on the upper left box would have a view that experts are people who wear ties. And they might like experts. The people on this other side might have a view that we don't like experts in general on this philosophy. And so therefore, someone who doesn't look like an expert, he looks like, I mean, I'm not sure if is it like me or is it a predisposition. Is there any way to unpack that in a experiment about what people think about experts?
I mean, I think that that would be a really good experiment. And one thing I would want to disentangle, though, is a kind of generic aversion to expertise versus a kind of aversion to expertise that's conditioned by the association people make about what sort of. I think a lot of people who are. Yeah, well, see, I think that might be my strategy if I'm trying to market this. But I think a lot of people, you know, they're skeptical of the experts until they find the guy at MIT who says intelligent design, and then all of a sudden, hey, you know, let's have him on our show and so forth. But here's a really interesting thing: is that one finding is that trust in expertise, you know, trust in government regulators is a strong predictor of whether people aren't worried about risk. That's actually conditional, you know, on whether your cultural orientation is. And so, it's not the case that the individualists, they don't trust the experts, but they're risk skeptical. They think the experts are just going to override very sensible decisions. Whereas for hierarchs, it really does make a difference. So. Yeah, we have more time for one more question.
Can you tell me very briefly, so what went into the definition of individualist, the originalist?
Oh, yeah. Well, so we have scales, right, that use a bunch of items, kind of attitudinal items. We can use short forms of them and so forth, but they have certain psychometric properties that are good. Like, you know, so that's individualism. You know, just a bunch of statements, some of which we adapted from other studies of people who use this similar frameworks, you know. Same thing for hierarchy, you know. One thing you can be pretty confident is that it's not that people are deciding they think global warming isn't happening, therefore it's a good idea for society not to be so soft and feminine. You know, it's pretty clear. I can give you a story about why somebody who believes that might believe certain things about risk, but it's pretty hard to believe. Believing things about risks is giving you these kinds of attitudes. But yeah, so we have scales like that, and they're just psychometric. I mean, you could have behavioral ones. That would be really interesting, too. I think very hard. So, okay, well. Oh, it really just came. Is there now?
Yeah.
Is it involved scraping in the?
It's not.
Yeah, I read about that.
They've always just assumed the incidence was equally high. And now they found it. Right.
I don't know about the
Well, what we do is we...